Hey, welcome back to another Babylon podcast. I am Tim Callender.
And I am Summer Brooks.
And tonight we are going to be discussing J. Michael Straczynski's autobiography, Becoming Superman.
Yes, this book came out this past summer and has become a runaway hit, bestseller on Amazon, to the point where at one point I was able to get the hardcover edition for like $12, which totally surprised me.
That's what I spent for mine, and I was very surprised about that. Worth every penny, and I think it's fair to say from the start here, not only are there here there be spoilers, but here there be triggers. Anybody who's followed Straczynski's career in interviews, he has alluded to some of his childhood situation, but it isn't until this book that you get the full extent of it. So before we dig into all that, I have to say this: it is not the book that I expected, and the title Becoming Superman, while it may be interpreted as being very egotistic, it turns out that is not the case at all and is very much appropriate to the life of Joe Straczynski as he sets it down.
And I will add to it that I have not yet read the earlier chapters because of not knowing how I would process or handle situations that he went into that are similar to my own upbringing in some cases. I have joked over the years that I would have been better off being left in the woods to be raised by wolves. That's not an exaggeration. It really isn't. And when I lived in Arizona, I moved 2,500 miles away from everyone I was related to by blood on purpose. The fact that I am back in this cradle right now is painful for me every day. And I'm just waiting for all this stress and pain to turn me into a mutant superhero so I can just fly the fuck away. But that's another story.
I think you need to eat some radioactive spiders or something for that, Summer.
Not spiders. Anything but no, not
Okay,
spiders.
well, radioactive something. Drink some radioactive coffee.
We have feral cats and deer that will actually stand 10 feet away from you while you're shooting compound bows at targets. The
Wow.
deer around here do not give a crap about anything. They'll sit there, whole herd of them, 8 of them, 20 yards away. My brother's shooting compound bows, shooting arrows at targets, and they don't care.
That's okay. That's the very definition of badass. I'm sorry. That's just really, that is, wow.
They
That is incredible.
literally do not care. They'll just, traipse on by. Yo, dude, what's up? And he'll just look at him like, all right, y'all done. It's funny. It's hilarious. But yeah, there's things that I was not ready to read yet, and maybe I never will be. But I skipped over to the part where he's in Hollywood already. He's working on Real Ghostbusters and Captain Power and all that. And I wish I could have dug up my Captain Power DVDs because we talked to those guys when the DVD came out, and I would have wanted to go back and match up stuff to what he was saying. I'm like, I want to match these up just because out of my own curiosity, It's easy enough to match up the stuff that he talks about for Babylon 5 because, well, we have Babylon 5 in our DNA now.
Yes, right, exactly. Well, and I'll say this about that. I'm almost embarrassed now to think that I'm a snob, that I avoided most all those because I just, a lot of those kids' cartoons really left a bad taste in my mouth because they were clearly product tie-ins. Ironically, the one that I liked a lot was it was Transformers Beast Wars,
okay,
which was an early CG cartoon, and I liked it because the writing was pretty sharp and funny. And it turns out Larry DiTillio was I don't know if he was a producer or a head writer on that show, but anyways, he was involved. And when B5 came along and I saw his name on the credits there in the first and second season, I was like, oh, okay, I know this guy's work. And so, but it's, so it's interesting to read how he was involved in shows like Jason the Wheeled Warriors, and he was involved in She-Ra, and involved in He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, mm-hmm. and in Becoming Superman, he talks about how you generally want to avoid anything that's named Guy and something else. but he talks about being on Jason the Wheeled Warriors, and that's where he met DiTillio, and how most all of the other writers just, you know, let's write a script, let me get paid, let me get out of here. And he and DiTillio worked to try to make sense of a senseless universe, right? They were very much into the world building and were kind of a thorn in the side for the producer, who just wanted the scripts and pay the guys and get out of my office kind of thing, right? So they were getting, you know, they would be like, well, why does it work this way? Why does this nonsensical thing actually work? But that led them to working on He-Man, and it led them to working on She-Ra, and She-Ra was very well received, and one of the struggles that they had was trying to make a strong, kick-ass female character and running afoul of the network censors and producers, who didn't think that's what kids wanted to see.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that was the thing that a lot of viewers were responding to, is that she was strong and capable. And I think he talks about how they couldn't show her using her weapon, so it was like she would have to spin around, and then somebody would be mysteriously knocked off screen, you know?
Yeah.
Kind of.
The one that got me actually angry was his description of how the consultants who were brought in at the end of the first season of Real Ghostbusters, every suggestion they made was misogynistic, sexist, racist, idiotic, ageist, talking about belittling, you know, the intelligence of children. And yes, while children may be feral pack animals who with a herd mentality and a viciousness unprecedented in the history of the world, they know what they like. They want to see what they can be, not what they might also see in the kid seated next to them who they really just want to punch, you know?
Right. And and they also know when they're being bullshitted.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right. And that was the thing. You know, one of the things Straczynski talks about is these consultants saying, you know, well, children want to see this and whatever else. And he says, show me your data. And they said, well, only someone with a degree in psychology would understand this. And he goes, I have a degree in psychology. Show me your stuff.
That's awesome.
That did not sit well with them. Right.
But here's the part that made me so angry. It's like that season of that show had garnered really good ratings, was Emmy nominated, and these consultants came in and threw out all these bullshit. And I'm like, somebody didn't realize the epicness of their mistake. And my thinking is, from, you know, literally, if you want to change Hollywood, you take these consultants, these focus groups, these executives who plan ideas, and do the Garibaldi method. Give me your idea. If you're right, you get a bonus. If you're wrong, I'll eat you for lunch. Or worse yet, if you're wrong and you cost us the show, you get to pay back the fee we paid you plus 10%.
Yeah.
That will erase all of these charlatans from the Hollywood gene pool in 2 seconds. It's like, you screw up, you have to pay us back the money plus interest because you cost us money.
Well, to that point, Straczynski stood his ground. He left the real Ghostbusters. The network changed it to what the consultants and censors wanted, which was Slimer and the real Ghostbusters, mm-hmm. the junior Ghostbusters, softened Janine, and the show immediately tanked.
Mm-hmm.
And so they came back with their tail between their legs a little bit, saying, hey, will you come back for the third year? And he said, okay, but only on these conditions. And they agreed, and his first story was basically how Janine had been possessed by a demon to make her appear what the demon thought other people wanted her to see. And while it was apparently a script that was very much about accepting who and what you are, and because the other Ghostbusters said, no, we loved you the way you were, it was also very clear that Straczynski was equating network censors and consultants with basically hellspawn demons.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, that literally is the alien abduction pod people replacement story.
Yes. Right. Yes. And when all was said and done, as he ran afoul of censors yet again, he not only said goodbye, he wrote a piece, which I've got to find now. And it was a piece about basically the unholy alliance between censors and consultants and how they're, as you say, they're misogynist and racist and ageist and sexist and all the rest. And Straczynski wrote it, and his agent said, you know, if you publish this, you'll never work in animation again. And like we talked about a moment ago, you know, never start a fight, but be prepared to finish it. And he ended up selling it to a magazine he had noted fought against censorship in the past, and that was Penthouse. And when he got a call from their nonfiction editor, they said they'd like to buy the piece. But why did he choose Penthouse? He said, because every consultant is going to want to read this thing. And the idea that they're going to have to buy a magazine full of racy photos tickles me to no end. And as Straczynski said, the editor laughed on and off for about 5 solid minutes. And sure enough, the piece was published, and within 24 hours of publishing, his agent got calls from everywhere in animation saying he will never work for them again, and he never has.
And technically never has had to. I mean, seriously.
Well, and that's kind of the interesting thing, is that in a lot of ways he has, by standing by his principles, he has managed to continue to advance his career and also to make the changes and shifts that he's needed to stay true to himself as a writer. I mean, I think that's really the bottom line to that. When he's finished with animation, he has moved on to writing and television. And he talks about how his agent pushes him to submit to Jake and the Fat Man, which he really wasn't interested in doing, but that's where he meets Jeri Ryan. And was very struck by her sincerity and her eagerness to work with him. And he basically sells a spec story that involves Robert Conrad. Robert Conrad?
No.
It was a Conrad. Who is it?
Yeah, William. Conrad. William. William. Conrad, right? Yes.
Where he's basically kidnapped by somebody he had put away years ago. So he's kidnapped and tied to a chair for the whole episode. And they loved it because they said, Conrad hates to walk. and so that led to working in, you know, with Jake and the Fat Man. And when Jeri Taylor and the other producer, whose name escapes me right now, they fall afoul of network executives, and they quit the show. He quits with them, but then moves with them to Murder, She Wrote, and, you know, sticks with that. And as he's working through that, he's also done a stint at the revitalized Twilight Zone. And one of the things he talks about, especially with the working on the Twilight Zone, is writing scripts where he begins to confront some of the demons and the horrors of his past, and using that as a way to tell stories but also to kind of come to terms with what his life has been. And he talks about writing a script about an abused wife who gets a porcelain Doberman that basically becomes her guardian, literally, and learned later on that women's shelters were using it as a way to help women face what the traumas they had gone through. So when Twilight Zone ends and Murder, She Wrote ends, he's working on Captain Power. And actually, the reason he gets Captain Power is because he's one of those rare ducks who had worked in children's television and live action television. So that's where he meets Doug Netter and John Copeland. And they work on Captain Power and, of course, fall again victim to censors and those looking to blame shows for the wayward youth of America.
Mm-hmm. I cannot stress enough the hypocrisy of the people of a certain age at that point in time who are all, oh my goodness, the children, think of the children, we can't have any violence. I'm like, you grew up on the best Daffy Duck, Bugs Bunny, and Tom and Jerry cartoons out there, and you censored them? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I know, it's ludicrous. And one of the things that Straczynski mentions is that there was a report that said that Captain Power featured 133 violent acts every episode.
Right.
And he says, first of all, that's ludicrous because there's not enough time in a 20-minute children's syndicated show to do that.
Right,
and he found
right.
out after some digging, they were counting every bullet fired.
Oh my goodness.
Act.
Oh my
right.
goodness.
Right. So, you know, he says when you're messing with the data the way you want, it comes up as anything. But through Captain Power, he ends up pitching Babylon 5. And one of the things that I found was interesting about the book once he gets into his career. For me personally, I'm really only ever been focused on the Babylon 5 work. Go figure, right? Mm-hmm. So reading what he writes about B5, with very few exceptions, he doesn't retell a lot of the stories that you and I and other B5 fans have heard through the years. It isn't a kiss and tell kind of book. The biggest revelations, I think, is he goes into a little more detail about Michael O'Hare.
Mm-hmm.
And that situation, and the Straczynski had heard word that there was trouble on set, and he called in O'Hare to his office to talk about what's going on, and O'Hare launches into discussion about how he thinks the FBI and CIA are spying on him, and if he can just figure out what the newspapers are telling him, he'll be able to figure it all out. And Straczynski talks about how this is the first, you know, the phrase "feel your blood freeze." It's like this is where he knew what that felt like, because here they were working on a show, and his lead is basically about to have a psychotic break. And he knows that if they, you know, as and when he can talk to O'Hare in lucid moments, O'Hare is like, let me just finish the season, because if we stop while I try to get better, the show shuts down, everybody loses their job, and you lose the show. And so Straczynski talks about writing some of the later scripts that reduce some of Sinclair's presence in them. And then, of course, we all know that he left the show. He comes back for the War Without End two-parter, because doing a guest shot is less stressful than being the lead of the show, for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And he says when O'Hare came back for that, he was in good spirits. He was happy to be able to finish out the story arc, if you will. And that's, you know, where – when the first season ends, where Straczynski says, I'll take your story to my grave. And O'Hare says, no, take it to mine. And as he says, people need to know that anybody, even a space station commander, can suffer from mental problems. And people need to know that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, you know, and it's and the reason though that O'Hare didn't want anything said while he was still alive was that he was hoping to at least continue a career of guest shots on various shows. And if word got out that he was suffering from a mental illness, he knew he'd never work again. And of course, you know, as time went on, Straczynski and Kathleen Drennan did what they could to support him. Both financially and emotionally, you know, but over time, you know, it just wasn't enough to keep him from falling into his illness, you know, and when he died, while it was I believe it was heart failure or a heart attack, the Michael O'Hare that people knew was pretty much gone from what Straczynski says and relating what O'Hare's friends and relatives had said. So it's really, you know, he goes into a little more detail around that in the book. He talks a little bit more about the B5 DS9 connection. And that was news because we know the story that he pitched to Paramount and it was, you know, okay, thank you very much, but no thanks. And one of the things I didn't know is that Catherine Drennan had gotten a paid internship on Next Generation. And she was in the room when Jerry Taylor and Michael Piller pitched to the writer's room, here's what we want to do for the next Star Trek spinoff. And she stood up, she says, I got to go. I can't work here. And they go, why? It's like, because this sounds an awful lot like my husband's show that he's working on. And the general consensus was that the executives at Paramount who had heard the B5 pitch from Straczynski and Netter and Copeland took those notes and then gave them, you know, basically said, hey, we've got an idea of the show, gave it to Taylor and Piller and whoever else was involved. That's sort of been the common wisdom. But Straczynski talks about talking to an executive from Warner's, I think, and I mean, I could dig through the book, but
I remember a story that came out a couple of years ago where a quote unquote former executive confirmed, he's like, yeah, I was in the room when that happened. It was totally ripped off. It was in one of those Pro Sound magazines, I believe. And somebody had tweeted at JMS and says, hey, have you seen this article? And Straczynski's reply was, huh, so the penny starts to drop or something like that. And it's been confirmed, like unofficially, officially, like, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Yeah, we know they stole it, but what are we going to do about it now? Nobody's going to take this fight on because you can't win it. I
Okay,
mean,
so
'cause
there's.
after 25 years, Babylon 5 is still in the red,
Well, right, but.
despite selling $1 billion worth of home video, show's in the red. Sorry, don't no royalties to pay out.
Okay, so, but here's there's a little other wrinkle to this, that hasn't come out until like 2013. And he says it was online through IO9. And
Maybe that
this
was it.
was, yeah, so this individual is named Stephen Hopstaken, who is a marketing specialist who worked at Warner International Television Distribution. And what he said is that Paramount and Warner's had agreed to jointly start their own new network together. And they had DS9 and they had B5, and they figured, well, there's only one room on television for one space station at war story. And do we go with an unknown or do we go with a brand name Star Trek? And so, in the midst of all of this, that's when the pilot, The Gathering, is shot, and Warner's is kind of, you know, they all the other shows that ended up on P10, they just bought straight out, right? And they were going to buy B5, but then no, we need you to shoot a pilot. Okay, that's fine. We're not going to, you know, put it through any focus groups, and then they do, and then they wait. And it turns out the reason why is because Paramount basically backed out of their agreement with Warners. And Warners was suddenly scrambling to try to put together their own network and figured, well, we've got a space station TV show. Let's put that together and let it go. And so the reason, if you recall, there was some discussion, well, why didn't you sue Paramount for copyright infringements? And part of it was, you know, at the time, well, you know, if we'd done that, neither show would have been produced and nobody would have gotten anything, right? But the other part of it is that neither network really wanted to have their shenanigans exposed.
But the financial shenanigans have nothing to do with that part. Yeah, no, the other shenanigans are ridiculous, because this was going to be the network that they formed together, but they broke apart, and then we got PTEN instead, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, that's the deal there. So that was that little piece of it. You know, I hadn't heard, but you know, for other instances around Babylon 5, like the Blackpool Convention and Claudia Christian's departure, he is very neutral about it. He just says it's, you know, we had an issue that we had to work around, and I think that's interesting in terms of writing the book, that information is already out there, and that apparently he didn't feel the need to rehash it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's another instance on another show. Jeremiah, he talks about. And he makes mention that while he was in Canada working on Jeremiah, there was an executive producer on the show who was busy basically doing everything he could to blacklist Straczynski from working. So when he comes back to Hollywood, nobody wants to have anything to do with him. But all he says about it is, if I were to say anything more, it would set off a firestorm of lawsuits that no one would recover from. So again, this autobiography isn't, if you're looking for a kiss and tell, if you're looking for something that's going to get into the dirt of how the television sausage is made, you might be a little disappointed. But I thought it was interesting because he focuses more on overcoming the obstacles.
Mm-hmm. And say, how do you and this is what, you know, this is an echo in my own life. How do you overcome the obstacles that other people have stabbed you in the back with, and you don't know how far they have taken your blood and passed it around to other people? As it's like, hey, if this starts glowing, run away from this person. Don't listen to them. Don't buy anything they create, because I say so. How do you overcome that without, you know, knives?
So here's the thing. Here's what gets interesting, and this gets back to the title, Becoming Superman. It isn't about becoming a superhero or better than anybody. For Straczynski, who's from the day he was born, it was a horror show. He talks about when he first finds comics as, you know, before he was 10. And the thing that resonated with him with Superman was that Superman was honest and truthful and stood up for what was right. And our comment earlier about how kids know when they're being bullshitted, Straczynski knew that despite everything that was going on, he knew somewhere that it was all wrong. And he basically held on to Superman's credo of do the right thing. He held it to his heart. And that was his guiding, you know, his guidepost. He says at one point that you don't trust any father unless they're from Krypton or Smallville.
Hmm.
And so those were things that kind of were guiding lights for him through his childhood. And also that he decided at some point that he was never going to let them break him, whoever that was. You know, he's talked before about how destitute his family was. And so that made him a target for bullies, and he decided he wasn't going to let them win. So they would beat him up, and he would always fire back some insult, to the point where they would leave him alone because nobody wanted to be tagged with, like, you know, beating someone to death or whatever, right? But he also had encounters with enough adults that showed him that there was a better, brighter future for him. And they were creative types. He talks about a painter who was the lover of his grandmother and the only man that she loved, he thinks. But he understood that Joe needed a safe place and provided that for him, psychologically, if you will. When he finishes at the high school that he finishes at, and Joe has talked often about how often his family moved, and we'll get into that here in a minute to get really spoilery. The high school he finishes at, he had two teachers who encouraged him to continue writing. And it's interesting that the thing that started him writing is when he was 10 or 12, he gets this little dime book at the Catholic school he was attending at the time. And he's reading a story about this boy who has an ice cream cone, and the ice cream cone falls, and he no longer has the ice cream. And Straczynski relates that he started crying because he could understand what that feeling was like. And then he stopped and goes, wait a minute. What is this arcane magic that with these words, this writer has elicited an emotion from me? And he closed the book and he does an experiment. Let's see, it has the same effect. And he opens it, reads the same passage, and it has the same effect on him. And he says that moment he knew he wanted to be a writer. And he talks about how he had the two teachers who encouraged him to continue to write. He talks about a chance meeting with one of his heroes when he's in high school, who turns out it was like an arts festival at a nearby college. And, you know, people can look at art, and Straczynski's sitting there with some of the short stories he's written, and only one person really stops to read them. It's a man in a suit, and he thinks it's Straczynski, says he looks familiar, and the man finishes this couple of stories, says, okay, two words for you, kid. Cut every third adjective, and don't let them stop you from telling the stories you want to tell. And the man walks away, and somebody comes up and says, you know, you just talked to Rod Serling. So those are the things, you know, those are the things that kept him sane. Now, he does talk about, again, the abuse doesn't even begin to describe the kind of monster his father was, and that he had to get out, and he falls in with a Christian sect that fortunately he doesn't become brainwashed with, but he finds some solace and acceptance there until he realizes that the leader is really, you know, he's having dalliances with a number of women in the church. Mm-hmm. And he's like, no, this is not good. Right. You know, so he leaves that but that's the guidepost. He says for him, becoming Superman is about being honest and being truthful and fighting for what's right. And that's, you know, what he has, you know, used as a guidepost. And he's very, again, not in a kiss and tell way, but he talks about how the fact that coming from a family of such toxic quality, he feels that his personality for dealing with other people, he's drawn from watching how others have interacted amongst themselves. And so he kind of, in the book, he describes himself as sort of a Lego personality. He's got these bricks that he can plug in. Oh, I'm in this kind of situation. All right, these are the 10 bricks I need to be able to interact with people. And, you know, he talks about later in life, he goes to a therapist and he's diagnosed and he's, you know, he's on the spectrum a little bit, you know, and that he is, he's, he's better off being by himself because he has all those characters that he's using to write his stories with. You know, and he, and the only thing he really talks about, you know, he talks about marrying Catherine and how difficult that was for her. But again, never in any gory details. And when he finally says, I think maybe we need to divorce, he says she was already knew it was coming because she is an astute individual with healthy, active emotions, you know, but they remain the best of friends. He says they go out to dinner and catch movies and all the rest. It's just that for him, he needs to be by himself. So it's a really, it's a powerful book that way to see how he managed to hold on to, you know, making the different decisions. You know, some of it at the beginning is, you know, my father's a horrible person, so I'm going to do not, you know, the opposite of what he does. But he talks about how he explores that in some of the early comics he wrote. He wrote a story with Cyborg versus Two-Face, and how they're both disfigured individuals, but how Harvey Dent's like, I have to be evil because I have no choice. This is what life has done to me. And Cyborg is like, no, you know, that's a choice you make. So it's fascinating. It's a fascinating story. And to see how he's managed to continually work hard, and there's no doubt about it. He talks about how hard he's had to work as a writer, and the first bit of advice that Harlan Ellison gave him before, you know, they became friends was, you know, it's like, are you writing stories? Yeah. Are you selling anything? No. Well, you're not selling anything because they're crappy, so you just need to write all the crap out. And so basically starts writing like a madman just to get all the crap out, as it were. So, you know, it's a strong story. You know, he talks about writing Changeling and how that's really been a project that had been off and on for him when he was a journalist in the 80s, that he came across this story and he knew there was something there, but he didn't know what to do with it. And it really wasn't until many, many years later that he had enough experience as a writer and as a human being to understand what the story was and how to tell it. So yeah, if you're looking for the details on how your favorite show was made or how he goes about doing what he does, you're not going to find it. If you're looking for the dirt on whatever, you're not going to find it. You know, when he talks about what happened to Michael O'Hare, when he talks about Jerry Doyle, when he talks about Jeff Conaway, it's more about how secrets can destroy you, you know, and that, again, being open and honest is the best way to try to live your life.
And for people who do want a little bit more story behind the story, in regards to He-Man and She-Ra, there's a documentary on Netflix right now called The Power of Grayskull. I interviewed as the producer or the director, I think it was the director for that a few months ago on Slice of Sci-Fi. And Straczynski and D'Attilio and fantasy author Barbara Hamley are in it, because they were writers on the show, and they get some significant screen time talking about He-Man and She-Ra and writing those stories and everything. So just a little side addition if you want. And like I said, if you are a fan of He-Man and She-Ra, that documentary is a good documentary. And bonus, it's got Straczynski and D'Attilio in it.
Yeah.
I will someday read those earlier chapters. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. There's just too much there that echoes my own life, upbringing, and my attempts to deal with that have not been successful.
Yeah, and it's interesting. he talks, as we've learned, and we talked about when we interviewed JMS on the Babcast all those years ago, and he talks about all the moves he made. It turns out there may have been more to that than just his father trying to stay ahead of creditors. Yeah, and I, you know what? I don't think we will say much more about that because it's an interesting story that way.
Mm-hmm. And it's in the book. It's in the book.
Yeah.
If you can get the book, go get it. Go read it. Put it on your shelf. Read it bits at a time. It has a very detailed table of contents that will help guide you as to which chunks to tackle first. If you want to avoid the gruesome. I don't know that there's a better way to describe that.
It is, I mean, and here's the thing. I'll say this about that. Everything is in there. I mean, it is really like if just when you think it can't get any worse, it does. You know, that's just the truth of it. So anyways, but yeah, it was not the book I expected. And I'm glad that I went into it with a certain amount of skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
And I came away having a greater appreciation for his story.
So we're giving this book a thumbs up.
Yeah, I think so. Yes.
Cool. I'm trying to think. Yeah, we're still taking voicemail messages for those of you who want to participate in the Feedbackapalooza. I have not yet come up with a better hashtag other than Feedbackapalooza.
Is there a better possible?
I don't think so, because I'm not sure that anyone else would or could every – well, they could use it, but I don't know if they would use it because that's kind of our thing, you know?
Yeah, right.
I really should have all of this written down, but we can be found at BabylonPodcast.com. Wait, do we have any more to say about the Becoming Superman? Are we good?
Nope, I think we're good. I think that's it.
Okay.
Read it.
Read it.
Read it. It's worth the read. And it's actually something of a page turner.
Yes, there are probably three or four good true crime or detective stories in there.
Yeah.
And I will leave it at that. But yes, the place to find us is BabylonPodcast.com. We're on Twitter at Babylon Podcast, and yes, I do tweet out the daily Monday through Thursday airings of Babylon 5. We have just this week actually, went from the end of season 5 back to the beginning of season 1, so we're starting all over again, and so it begins.
And so it begins.
Yep. And like I said, this time around, I'm including all the links to the old Babylon Podcast episode. The discussion we had about Midnight on the Firing Line also included the interview with Bear Burge. And the discussion we had about Soul Hunter included our first interview with Bruce Boxleitner. How cool is that?
That's wonderful. Love it.
Where else? Let's see. We're on Twitter. We're on Twitter, and it's only Twitter. I am addicted to Twitter. I have become addicted to Twitter. I own up to that. I tweet with Slice of Sci-Fi. I tweet with Babylon Podcast. I tweet with Writers After Dark. I tweet with my voiceover handler, Summer Talking, and there's like three others out there that I don't use a whole lot, but yeah, that's me. I think after we're done this little visit from Beyond the Rim, I'm actually going to hunker down and get lurkersguide.net or .org, one of the two. I own them both. I don't remember which one's the website. I think it's lurkersguide.org. I'm going to get that fixed up. I'm going to sweep the dust off of it and actually do with it what I intended to do with it 10 years ago that I didn't do.
And I am about the only social media I do is Facebook. And yes, I appreciate all the well wishes for Day of the Dead. Thank you very much.
You realize
Brad and Neil and oh my
God. You have to select the best of the best of those for us to talk about during the Feedbackapalooza.
Yes. I'll pick out some classic ones.
Oh, and this week, the Zocalo livecast, you have to go to YouTube and watch the video they did talking about Day of the Dead and read some of the comments, because they asked some really good questions, and the one really good one was, what if Ivanova was still on the station and in that area? Who would have appeared to her? And most people said, oh, her mother. Somebody said, I said her brother, and then I thought about it. I'm like, no, what if Talia appeared to Ivanova?
Yes. Oh, see, there are so many better pairings than Lanier and Morden.
I have said that the pairing of Lanier and Morden makes sense, because Morden betrayed his people for his own personal gain, and as we see, Lanier has set himself up. Lanier is living a delusion, and he's setting himself up, and he walks through that same door, and Morden tried to warn him not to.
Morden didn't do anything. He sat there and read the paper the whole time.
No, he opened the door. Morden said, you're going to betray the Amlashak. And instead of asking the question, Lanier ignored him. He got his little arrogant acolyte flags up. He just kind of sat there and meditated. And Morden says, I got nobody to talk to. What's the crossword today? And so that was all on Lanier.
Yeah. It was lame.
But no,
Sheridan Kosh would have been interesting.
That could have been interesting, but I still think. Oh my goodness!
No, we're not going there now.
We're not going there now. But no, just imagining what the story could have been if it had been Ivanova and Talia. Oh my, that could have been just awesome.
Yes.
But anyway, yes, we are. If you are on Facebook, please feel free to harass Tim about his his opinions on Day of the Dead. And we will discuss those on our Feedbackapalooza episode, which probably will be our last episode for this go-round. But like I said, check out the website, leave comments, say hi to me over on Twitter at Babylon Podcast. And if you want to call in a voicemail, the number is 602-635-6976, or you can record something yourself and email it to babylonpodcast@gmail.com. All of the different places you can listen to the show are listed there. We're on Apple Podcasts, we're on Google Play, we're on iHeartRadio, and I think Player FM too, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah. How about that?
Yeah, we're all on all those little streaming podcast gizmo duties you can get from your smartphone.
So you got no excuse to find us.
To not find us.
That too.
Well, thank you guys for listening. And we have a couple more episodes left in it, but catch up quick.